and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's churlish and self-defeating criticism of the special counsel just appointed to investigate his ties to the Russians, and speak with John Dean, the former counsel to President Nixon and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States, the best-selling author of Conservatives Without Conscience, who is now an analyst on CNN. He joins us to discuss the comparisons now being made to Watergate and Trumpgate, and Trump's propensity to make things worse for himself by attacking the press, the CIA, the FBI, James Comey, and now Robert Mueller. We will also look into the possibility that Trump will make a terrible choice by appointing the Republicans' favorite Democrat, former Senator Joe Lieberman, as the next director of the FBI, and how that will be received at the FBI and within the Department of Justice. Then we'll analyze what the number two Republican in the House, Kevin McCarthy, said in June of last year in a private meeting with Paul Ryan and top Republicans, where he remarked that, quote, "There's two people I think Putin pays, Rohrabacher and Trump." Then after some bemused laughter, he interjects, "Swear to God." After at first denying this to the Washington Post, once Paul Ryan was told there was a tape of the conversations, McCarthy's bombshell was brushed off as an attempt at humor. Gustavo Arellano, the editor of the OC Weekly, joins us to discuss his local congressman, the former red beta turned Putin lover, and an article by Matthew Croker in the OC Weekly, "Putin Paying Dana? Rohrabacher Claims He Man-Crushes on Vlad for Free." Then finally, we'll examine the revival of the failed war on drugs by Attorney General Jeff Sessions and look for underlying motives in wanting to fill the already full jails again with young black men and recriminalize marijuana while ignoring a national epidemic of opiate addiction from prescription drugs. Inga Frickland, a former Chicago prosecutor who wrote Our Disastrous Afghan Drug War at the request of the U.S. Army War College after spending 5 years in Afghanistan advising the U.S. Army and Marines, joins us to discuss her article at Vox, "I Prosecuted Drug Offenders in the 80s. It Was a Disaster. Why is Sessions Taking Us Back?" And joining us now is John Dean, who is the former counsel to Richard Nixon, and prior to that was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of the Law Reform Commission, and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. He is a best-selling author of such books as Blind Ambition, Worse Than Watergate, and Conservatives Without Conscience. He's also a columnist at Justia.com and is now an analyst on CNN. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Dean.
Thank you, Ian.
And John, what do you make of the resistance on the part of Michael Flynn to respond to the subpoena from the Senate Judiciary Committee? I mean, I know there's a lot to cover. you can't keep up with Donald Trump, frankly. But let's start with that. What's the significance of that?
That would indicate his lawyers telling him that he's got criminal problems and he's, in essence, he hasn't invoked the Fifth Amendment yet, but he can always do that. It suggests to me, as I say, he's protecting himself from criminal liability by refusing to turn the material over to the Senate.
But prior to that, he floated the idea that he would make a deal and he had a story to tell. At least that's what his lawyer said.
Well, he was seeking immunity,
right,
and they obviously have not offered him that and probably will not. What they'll do now is they'll coordinate with the special counsel, Mueller, and as to any immunity or really anything they do in their investigation. They don't want to step on the federal prosecution.
Well, the assumption is that the memo by Comey, first of all, it's very likely that there are more memos of Comey squirreled away that may well be even more explosive than the one that was revealed by the New York Times the other day.
Very possible.
Very possible that it could be a slow drip here. But presumably, after Donald Trump made that approach to Comey on behalf of Flynn, and we don't know whether Trump did that because Flynn is his firewall, or whether indeed whatever Flynn did, he did it on the instructions of Trump. But nevertheless, when Comey came out of that meeting Trump had shooed out the attorney general and the vice president and wanted to talk to Comey alone, presumably Comey's boss, Attorney General Sessions, must have asked him what went on in that meeting, surely.
possible. And Comey is certainly enough of his own person that he might well say, I don't really feel at liberty to share that, and went back and drafted his memo.
Well, what does that say about Jeff Sessions? What do you hear from the Justice Department in terms of...
Well, I hear that he hasn't won the hearts and minds of the career people.
Well, that's not surprising. He does seem almost like a relic of the Confederacy. He seems to be totally out of touch. His war on drugs, which we'll be covering later in the program, seems like a complete throwback to the 1980s.
A waste of money at the federal level.
Right, right. So, obviously, you have been besieged with journalists asking you about connections between or analogies between Watergate and what's happening at the present. And I fear I'm following in their footsteps, only to the extent that I think that so far the analogies have been overblown. But
well, there are certainly echoes of the past that are being heard now. Everything from the style in which it's being done and some of the substance. Given the fact that the Watergate started with an effort to break in the Democratic headquarters to find information that might influence the election. The Russians accomplished that. They broke into the Democratic headquarters via computer, different technique and different technology today. So they start at the same place. What we don't know and did not know initially, if there is any collusion between Nixon and his reelection committee, and there's really, to my knowledge, never been any established as to Nixon giving any kind of orders that they should break into Watergate. There certainly were orders and instructions from the president to gather intelligence, just not a specific target. So we don't know yet what Trump was doing. We do know during the campaign he very openly at one point said, Russia, if you're listening, see if you can find 30,000 Hillary emails. So there are a lot of parallels. And they're coming down into this cover-up phase of it as well. Everything from the style with which he first fired the acting attorney general, Sally Yates, the style with which he fired the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, and then the director of the FBI. This isn't a man who's throwing any signals that he doesn't have anything to be worried about. To the contrary, every signal he's showing, and rather openly, is cover-up. So, as I say, they're not exactly parallel situations, but they certainly are similar situations.
And I just spoke on Sunday with your former colleague from the Nixon White House, Alexander Butterfield, and we talked about his reluctance to testify about the existence of the tape, and then not wanting to bring down a president. At the same time, he wasn't happy about the way Nixon treated people like you and others who had to go to jail, and he felt that Nixon was only out for himself in the final...
Well, I never made it to jail. I was in the witness protection program. They were more interested in keeping me alive.
Right, but others did, and he thought that Nixon didn't seem to have any compunctions about hanging other people out to dry. That maybe that's just the way presidents are. After all, it's an exalted...
Well, I don't have a sense that Donald Trump is out of the goodness of his heart worried about Michael Flynn.
Right.
I think he's worried about Donald Trump and what he either instructed Flynn or what Flynn knew from proximity as to Trump's actions. But clearly, Flynn is somehow central to all this, and with time I think we'll learn.
And again, I'm speaking with John Dean, who's the former counsel to President Richard Nixon, and prior to that was Chief Minority Counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States, and he's the best-selling author of such books as Blind Ambition, Worse Than Watergate, and Conservatives Without Conscience. He's also a columnist at Justia.com and is now an analyst on CNN. So given that Donald Trump, just yesterday before the Coast Guard graduates, who one would assume the parents and the graduates themselves were expecting an uplifting address from the President of the United States about the careers that their sons and daughters are about to enter into. Instead, you had this whining, woe is me speech about how there's never been a president in the history of the United States more afflicted and more badly treated. And again, I was going to mention to you that the other day, Alex, just completely off the cuff without any prompting, thought that the next president of the United States would be Mike Pence, and it would happen sooner than later. What is your sense then of whether Trump could, because of his mindset, because he feels beleaguered and mistreated, could the 25th Amendment come into play before all of these other threads worming their way through the justice system vis-a-vis Russia? And
I don't see any potential for the 25th Amendment being invoked. I actually worked on that when I was at the House Judiciary Committee. It was really designed to take care of a situation where the president was truly incapacitated. It was done in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination, and I thought, what would have happened had that man been comatose for the rest of his life but not died? And there would be no way to actually get the Vice President Johnson into the presidency. So that was a huge constitutional gap that was being addressed. While the language for fulfilling the duties of the office is there and might be interpreted broadly if you didn't know the legislative history behind the amendment, since we all do know why the amendment was drafted, it's just not likely to be used for a purpose like removing a president. And it takes all members. It takes a majority of two-thirds of the cabinet have to vote on it, and the vice president has to support it. Both houses of Congress requires a two-thirds vote to approve it. The president can contest it. It would be ugly. It would not work. So I think that's just pipe dreaming for those who feel strongly about Trump. Mm-hmm. More likely is what's happened now with this. We have a true and able prosecutor who knows his way around the federal system. He's a former assistant U.S. attorney. He's a former U.S. attorney. He's a former director of the FBI for a long term through both Republican and Democratic presidencies. He's highly respected. He is a no-nonsense, very capable lawyer. So you've got this is Donald Trump's worst nightmare if he's done something wrong. If he's done nothing wrong, this is the best of all cases for him, because if he's exonerated, it will be clearly because there is no there. So this cuts both ways. I mean, if as he claims, this is a witch hunt, Mueller will straighten it out very, very quickly, and it will go away. If it's not, he could well decide that he doesn't want to be president anymore and gently resign. There is precedent for that with Mr. Nixon. Or he could decide to let the process play out. And what, if passed, is prologue, and I think it is. Leon Jaworski, when he completed his investigation, made arrangements for the judge to authorize the grand jury information going to the House Judiciary Committee for impeachment proceedings. So there is that real potential, too. Also, the House and Senate are conducting their own investigations. I think they'll be around this criminal prosecution. But I think that this is probably going to be the extent of it. If there is no way to get this information to the American public, if it gets more convoluted and more stories come out, because I don't think that the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post are going to back off. They're going to keep reporting on this. Then they may need some kind of public commission to explain what exactly the Russians did, how they did it, how do we protect our system in the future, because nothing is more central to our government than our democracy and our election system working unencumbered by foreign influence.
But again, it seems that Trump is his own worst enemy. The White House had a boilerplate response to the appointment of former FBI Director Mueller as special counsel. And then Trump tweets a sort of petulant, angry tweet.
Yes, he undercut what was not a great statement, but certainly an acceptable statement. It took them 80 minutes to get out, so there must have been a lot of debate about it before it did come out. Right. And then he woke up early and decided he'd go to his Twitter.
Well, obviously, he's proactive and he fights back, and that was the sort of gist of his speech before the Coast Guard graduates yesterday. But he has a kind of firewall, obviously, with political people at the CIA, the DNI, the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, and Sessions at the DOJ, although now I'm beginning to understand why he got so angry that Sessions recused himself, because obviously Rod Rosenstein felt, I think he must have felt, that he had to restore his credibility. Do you think that's a factor with the few adults left in that White House, like General McMaster and General Mattis? How long can they be hung out to dry like McMaster was the other day, where he had to cover for Trump's gossiping?
Well, I'm sure McMaster is not very happy with the smudge on his reputation now, trying to deflect with disingenuous claims about what indeed had happened with the Russians in leaking or giving them intelligence without authorization of one of our intelligence gathering partners. So, you know, and people, there are a lot of jobs that are not filled in Washington because people don't want to work for the Trump administration, and he doesn't want anybody who's ever said a word of a negative nature about him. So he is so demanding of loyalty. He wants sycophants, and he's getting them, and they don't know anything about government or how it works, and it shows in the product, in the processes they're operating. So it's not he's got a huge albatross around him now with this special counsel. He has got to hire a very sophisticated lawyer out, because the White House counsel does not represent Donald Trump. They represent the office of the president. Now, he is the person who can speak for the office, but if he tells them to do something that is blatantly wrong, they have to ignore it. They cannot, you know, if they know that is not in the best interest of the presidency, this is post-Watergate. The rules of how lawyers represent entities has changed. And it's not the constituents of the entity, but the entity itself is the client. And the lawyer has to go to the level of protection to be the person who can represent that entity and make sure the entity is protected.
Well, so far, Don McCann, the White House counsel, has not equipped himself well, I don't think, even in his fundamental role of not just protecting the presidency itself, but also the current president. He seemed to have given Sally Yates the back of his hand.
We don't know that. All we know is the end result after he was forewarned about Flynn. We don't know if he did. We do know he reported it to the president. But we don't know what the president then said. Mm-hmm. He might have said, we're going to forget this. Just put that in your desk drawer and ignore it. So, you know, we can't assume, Ian, that it is the counsel who's misbehaving and saying, I'll take care of this, versus Trump, who I'm more inclined to believe would have said, let's try to avoid doing this.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it also, both in the transition, I think McCann, in fact, Flynn had gone to him and told him that he had visited the Russian ambassador and taken money from the Turks, etc. That seems to be also a bit of a lapse. Again, it leads you back to asking what it is that Trump has over Flynn, or Flynn has over Trump.
The White House counsel, McCann, is going to have to answer some of these questions at some point, mm-hmm. because they do raise real issues, and they're connected with the overall impact of the Russian influence and other foreign influence, which appears, you know, it will be in the special counsel's purview. So how this all comes out, I don't know. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is the White House counsel's office is a very powerful office under Trump. He's always used lawyers, and they have not cut back at all. McCann has hired about 25 really first-rate lawyers, lawyers who have left some of the best law firms in the country. They're clearly taking salary cuts to go there to work, and I just can't imagine the people he got to come over to the White House did it thinking they wanted to go to work in a hornet's nest. So this is going to be interesting how it plays out, because he's got talent, a lot of legal talent there, and they have to protect the presidency.
Well, just in closing, though, John Dean, what do you think of the idea that Joe Lieberman is likely to be the next FBI director?
I think that's just about the worst recommendation I could have envisioned. First, he's too old, and I have nothing against old people since I'm 3 years older than Joe. but the agents will recoil. It will hurt the department. It will hurt the agency and the bureau. So I just can't imagine it. There are so many able people to bring in. They're already reeling from the firing of Comey. You don't want to really make it worse by bringing in Lieberman, who has no federal law enforcement experience. He's not a former agent, not a former U.S. attorney. He just doesn't have any, you know, he was in the Senate, but that doesn't give him the skill set to really head our leading law enforcement investigative agency. So it's bad, and I don't think he's going to get a free ride in the Senate if they do that.
Well, just in closing, though, it would seem that there isn't anybody around that could make the kind of case that you made, which is a reasonable and rational one. Is that, at the end of the day, the problem?
That seems to be the problem. He won't listen to anybody.
Right.
He does all these gut instinct moves, and they're getting him in a lot of trouble.
Well, John Dean,
could end his presidency.
Well, on that note, a familiar one for you. I thank you for joining us, John Dean.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with John Dean, who is the former counsel to Richard Nixon, and prior to that was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. He is the best-selling author of such books as Blind Ambition and Worse Than Watergate and Conservatives Without Conscience, and is also a columnist at Justia.com and an analyst on CNN. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into remarks by the number two Republican in the House, Kevin McCarthy, that, quote, "There are two people I think Putin pays, Rohrabacher and Trump."
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gustavo Arellano, who is the editor of the OC Weekly, where he writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. He is the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America, and the editor of the article by Matthew Croker at the OC Weekly, Putin Paying Dana, Rohrabacher Claims He Man-Crushes on Vlad for Free. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gustavo Arellano.
Hola, Ian.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us. And this is an extraordinary piece of breaking news from yesterday that has been verified, in as much as there's actually an audio recording after first denying it, its existence. Paul Ryan's spokesperson had to come back and admit that it actually did, this conversation did take place, but it was all in jest. So Let's go to the heart of what they said. They were at a meeting, these top leaders of the Republican Party, on June of the 15th, 2016. They'd just been briefed in talks with the Ukrainian prime minister, who told them about what the Kremlin was up to in financing populist politicians to undercut democratic institutions in Eastern Europe. And and of course, this was also the day after the Washington Post reported that the Russians had hacked into the Democratic National Committee's computer network, and a month before Trump clinched the GOP nomination. So in effect, what he says is that McCarthy says, you know, Putin pays Trump and Rohrabacher. And then they all laugh. And then he said, I swear to God. And then quickly thereafter, Paul Ryan says, let's keep this quiet. No leaks, no leaks. Just keep it in the family. So that would indicate to me that Paul Ryan thought this was pretty alarming stuff that, that needed to be kept quiet. So how effective have they been in writing this off as kind of, you know, almost fraternity boy humor?
Yeah, this is a sad part about this, is that even if it's absolutely true, even if Putin gives Dana a gold-plated limousine with the you know, with the legend "To Putin" or "To Dana, love Putin, your favorite Russian," the voters of Huntington Beach would still overwhelmingly reelect Dana. Dana has been, the OC Weekly, and specifically my colleague R. Scott Moxley, we've been exposing him as a buffoon at best and as an employer, a former employer, I'll get to that later, for years. He's a horrible, horrible man, but it doesn't matter what Dana may do or who he alliances himself with, he will be reelected. So sure, people around the United States, they're disgusted. They're absolutely disgusted by Trump. We knew that already, but for many people, they're thinking, Dana Rohrabacher, who's this person? Then they start looking him up, and here you see someone who has a total man crush, not just on Trump, but especially on Vladimir Putin, one that precedes Trump by years, if not decades.
So it doesn't get to them that the number two guy in the Republican Party says there are two people I think Putin pays, Rohrabacher and Trump. That doesn't resonate?
Oh, of course it's not going to resonate, not to the Trump supporters, but definitely not to the voters of Huntington Beach, which I don't know if the, you know, especially in Southern California, maybe you don't want to go down to Huntington Beach because it's filled with a bunch of angry Trump bros. And these are the Trump bros and their parents who are electing someone like Dana again and again and again. All Dana has to do is take a picture of himself in a surfboard, even in his 60s, even as fat and lazy as he is now. He sends them out as a card. Hey, yeah, he's a surfing congressman. Yeah, surf's up, bro. U.S. Open of Surfing. And he gets reelected.
So how then did he go from a red-baiting cold warrior to Putin's best buddy in the Congress?
Yeah, here's a guy who Dana Rohrabacher has made a career out of. You know, he former speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, former editorial writer for the Orange County Register, one of the more noxious paper, daily newspapers around, and, you know, such an anti-communist warrior that he actually went down to Afghanistan during the Civil War there with the Mujahideen and eventually became the biggest, one of the biggest supporters of a little group called the Taliban. And that's something he, to this day, will defend and apologize for. But eventually, as the Soviet Union transformed into Russia, and all of a sudden, certain, you know, the oligarchs start cozying up to the Republicans because they're, you know, they're birds of a feather. He starts hanging out with Vladimir Putin, and as he so loves to tell the story, and sometime in the 90s, I think I can't remember in what city, but Putin challenged Dana to a arm wrestling match, and Putin overwhelmingly beat him. And ever since then, Dana has just been gazing longingly into the photo and whatever photos of Putin's out there. So to flash forward now to this era with Trump and his Dana's excuse is, well, you know, the Russians are no longer the Soviets, and we need the Russians to protect ourselves against radical Islamic terrorists because Russia has been so great in, you know, brutally suppressing Islamic terrorism, which is, we all know is bull. Look what happened in Chechnya, and also look at the human atrocities that Putin has done to suppress Muslims all across Russia. So it's just full of it.
And again, I'm speaking with Gustavo Arellano, who's the editor of the OC Weekly, where he writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. He is the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America, and the editor of the article by Matthew Croker at the OC Weekly, Putin Paying Dana. Rohrabacher claims he man crushes on Vlad for free. But In a way, though, there's a lot of confusion on the right and the left. It's pretty hard to see all these former Cold Warriors now making excuses for Putin. And on the left, a lot of people who normally are suspicious of the CIA are wishing the CIA could find the smoking gun to impeach Trump. So, and I get a lot of angry mail here at this left-wing Pacifica radio network from people who think you, by criticizing Putin, you're somehow engaging in McCarthyism. But what they don't seem to understand, and this is where I think there is a meeting of the minds, if you will, ideologically between Rohrabacher and Putin. Putin is a religious nationalist. He's a white, racist, religious nationalist. And isn't that, I don't know how religious Rohrabacher is, but he's certainly a white, racist nationalist.
Oh, absolutely. That's what gets you elected in his district, which goes from Rancho Palos Verdes all the way to Huntington Beach. And that's how politics have been working in Orange County for decades. Pledge your fealty to God, rail against illegal alien savages, and isn't that what's Putin doing with the with the Orthodox Church, with him going against LGBT folks in Russia and going after Muslims and other minority groups and just creating this idea of a resurgent Russia? Not so much. And I would what I would say to our friends on the left, he's not advocating for any socialism or communism or any sort of new economic model. What he's advocating for is oligarchies, and what he's advocating for is the myth of a pure white Russia that must get back its former terrains, like the Ukrainians and the Latvians and the Lithuanians. That is nothing for the left to be proud of. That's imperialism at its capitalistic, oligarchic, croniest worst. And that's all catnip for Dana, by the way, because that's the American imperial project.
But do you think there will be an investigation? Because the guy that's going to run against Rohrabacher next year, Harley Rauder, he's asking for the FBI to investigate the ties between Rohrabacher and the Russians. What are the chances of, one, this being taken seriously and investigated, and two, what does this Harley Rauder's chances look like?
Harley Rauder, I don't know him. I wish anyone against Dana the best of luck, and I doubt, again, Dana, and I please someone prove me wrong in the future, but I do not think Dana will ever lose an election. That's how retrograde and Neanderthal, and with all apologies to Neanderthals, any Neanderthal descendants out there, but that's how backwards the voters, Dana's constituents are. They love the guy, and there's no one in the district that has a name recognition to take him on, and that district is very territorial. They're not going to, even if you have a carpetbagger going in there that has the most best progressive credentials possible, they have no chance of defeating Dana. As regards to any investigation, you would hope so, but then again, Trump has not picked his neck, the person to replace Comey on the FBI, but Donald Trump and Dana Rohrabacher are really good friends. And Dana Rohrabacher is especially good friends with Jeff Sessions. They were recently, they had lunch together recently. We did a story about it where they know each other going back to the days when they were about 25 years ago, so if not earlier, actually. So Dana is a protected man in the Trump administration. It will take for the FBI or add to CIA to leak something or do anything. But that said, as long as we have a Trump administration, nothing will happen to Dana. And if that's, among the many disgusting things going on in American democracy right now, that's the worst, that you have an administration that would defend a man as odious and just gross as Dana.
But Trump apparently considered Dana Rohrabacher for Secretary of State.
As stupid as Trump is, he's not that stupid to put him in there. I'm actually surprised, though, that he didn't give him some sort of cherry, because even here in conservative Orange County, very few people wanted to openly support Trump, especially at the beginning. But Dana was the one, the most prominent person from the beginning. I did a story right after the election calling Dana the most powerful Orange County Republican in Washington, because he's the one who has the year. And remember, Orange County is still very Republican. There's only one Democratic congressperson, Lou Correa, who's basically a Republican, out in Washington. So that power the power structure of the Republican Party is still there, but Dana's the one who has the ear. So anything he wants will happen.
Well, nevertheless, Larry Sabato, who has this election forecasting blog, Crystal Ball, and he's taken pretty seriously, he thinks that Rohrabacher is more vulnerable than ever, and he has rated this district that you're talking about from likely Republican to leans Republican. So does that give you any hope here, or you seem to be
pretty convinced
that this is the march of the Neanderthals, right?
The Neanderthals were there March 25th in Huntington Beach when you had bonafide neo-Nazis beating up my reporters at the OC Weekly, and the police not arresting the neo-Nazis, but rather the Antifa who pepper sprayed people to save them. And who was the congressperson that day who was addressing all the pro-Trump marchers? Dana Rohrabacher. Those are the people who elect. We all know how good prognosticators did in the 2016 election. And again, I got on fight on Twitter with a liberal in Huntington Beach, and I want Dana gone. The OC Weekly, we've been covering him for 22 years, expose after expose after expose, and anyone would have gotten him, it would have been the Obama administration, but that didn't happen. But the voters of Huntington Beach will always vote him in. I mean, you'd have to have radical redistricting to take away as many voters from Dana as possible, and that's not going to happen in 2018. It won't happen until in 2020. About the only glimmer of hope is that supposedly Dana, next election, 2018, is going to be Dana's election because he wants to retire, although with this administration, the only hope, frankly, is for Trump to give him a position, some sort of position of responsibility in his administration. And then at that point, you're just going to make Dana from a Huntington Beach problem into a national problem. So I don't know if we want to throw Dana out into the world. He'll just do the same thing that he's done in Huntington Beach. Absolutely nothing, and just delegitimizing minorities and just being a nasty person.
Well, Gustavo Arellano, I thank you very much for joining us here. I was hoping you would have better news, but you've got your ear to the ground, and I believe what you're telling us. But it goes to the broader question of how come the people that support Trump are so immunized against reality, and that is a discussion we could have for the next year, I think. Thanks for joining us.
Gracias, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Gustavo Arellano, who's the editor of the OC Weekly, where he writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. He's the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America, and editor of the article by Matthew Croker at the OC Weekly, Putin Paying Dana, Rohrabacher Claims He Man-Crushes on Vlad for Free. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the revival of the failed war on drugs by Attorney General Sessions. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Inga Frickland, who is a former Chicago prosecutor and City of Chicago department head. She spent 5 years in Afghanistan working with local governments and the judiciary and advising the U.S. Army and Marine Corps. At the request of the U.S. Army War College, she wrote Our Disastrous Afghan Drug War and has an article at Vox, I Prosecuted Drug Offenders in the 1980s. It was a disaster. Why is Sessions taking us back? Welcome to Background Briefing, Inga Frickland.
Happy to be here.
And why do you think the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, is taking us back in time?
Well, I don't really know why he's doing it. I mean, some of it just seems to be can we return ourselves to the 1950s and declare, ignore everything we've learned since then and go back to cracking down on drugs? And then his recent order saying that he wants us to go back to mandatory minimums and tough sentences for any drug offenders. That's the first step he's taken to implement this point of view he has.
Well, early in the program, I was speaking with John Dean, the former White House counsel, who his testimony brought down President Nixon. And I asked him about, at the Justice Department, how do they, the career professionals, see Jeff Sessions? And he said they're not too happy with him. The morale is not great. He does seem like a kind of relic from the Confederacy. Is that just the problem, that this is just a man who really is out of touch with the times?
Well, he certainly is out of touch, but, I mean, Trump is the one who's appointed him. And, it, you know, your reference to the Confederacy, that's kind of interesting. You know, the Republicans have historically been states' rights people. States should be able to do whatever they want. Well, now here is Sessions pushing for a stronger federal intrusion into the states and what they're going to be doing. So maybe what states' rights all along meant was just the right of states to be able to curtail freedoms for their black citizens. Now it raises some real questions about what they had in mind all along.
Well, the reality of the moment is, and there was a book recently written about the idea, it's not an idea, it's a fact, that there are more African-American men in jail in this country than there were in chains during slavery. And it's worth noting that when you broaden the net, if you will, and lower the threshold to make criminalize more activity, in this case, you know, smoking marijuana, then you fill up the jails with more people. It's good for the private prison contractors, I'm sure. But doesn't it also mean that these people that have been swept up and incarcerated never get to vote again? So there's that. Isn't that a part of it? I don't know whether it's a...
That varies according to state law. In some places, people who are currently in prison can still vote. They'll bring a voting place there. Other places, they can vote again as soon as the sentence ended. In some other states, they can petition to have their right restored, which may or may not be granted. Which is real interesting that we have laws against drugs, but people who are affected by them, it's much harder for them to vote against it. Now, back during prohibition of alcohol, people convicted of alcohol offenses could vote to change the situation. So we've made it even more difficult to make changes in the drug laws by disenfranchising so many people.
But I'd make a bet, without knowing the full details, that the states that once you become a felon, your voting rights are taken away for life, I would make a bet that they are largely in the red states and particularly in the South.
That's true. And I think Florida is one of them. So Florida has now made some changes in the drug laws. So I think there's definitely an association with the red states. But it's a strong correlation, but it's not uniform right down the way.
And again, I'm speaking with Inga Frickland, who is a former Chicago prosecutor and City of Chicago department head. She spent 5 years in Afghanistan working with local governments and the judiciary and advising the U.S. Army and Marine Corps. At the request of the U.S. Army War College, she wrote Our Disastrous Afghan Drug War and has an article at Vox. I prosecuted drug offenders in the 1980s. It was a disaster. Why is Sessions taking us back? So let's go through your two experiences. The first one, prosecuting drug offenders in the 80s in Chicago, and then the more recent experience in the 2000s, living and working in Afghanistan. First of all, give us a sense of why you're making this analogy with what you're doing back then to what's happening now, this kind of production line of people just going through the Justice Department like something on a, like a bottle of Coca-Cola on a production line.
Well, between being in Afghanistan, which is one of the producer countries for, they actually export marijuana as well as opium poppy, and then seeing what happens with distribution and consumption in our own cities, especially the years I spent in Chicago. From start to finish, the whole thing was a disaster. What I saw as a young prosecutor in Chicago was, first of all, that almost all the defendants were black, and that did not match the ethnic mix that I would see out on the streets of Chicago. It was disproportionately black. I also saw what looked to me like corruption in the police department, because almost every drug arrest had the same phrase. Defendant dropped a baggie containing marijuana as I approached. You know, I really couldn't believe that this is what people on the streets normally did. And then I would look at people's rap sheets, you know, dozens of drug arrests. And I knew that this person was never going to get a job in the legitimate economy. And adding yet one more arrest to the record just made it even more unlikely. So all we were doing was cycling people back into the drug economy. And whenever you've got an economy with something which is illegal, there is going to be violence. Because it's a business, but they can't go to court to enforce franchise territories. About all they can do is shoot each other. Same thing that we saw in the U.S. 1920 to 1933 prohibition of alcohol. Remember Al Capone and the crime and corruption in Chicago and other cities. And as soon as prohibition was repealed, the violence stopped and everybody went back to suing each other in court. So something, when there is a commodity that people want, but it's illegal, it's going to be supplied and it's going to be violent. And that violence is, you know, what I saw in Chicago back in the 80s, and we're still seeing it today. Somehow we don't learn, we don't see that it's the illegality that's creating the problems. And then what I saw overseas, opium poppy used to be a pretty minor crop in Afghanistan. But then we showed up, declared that this was illegal. There's a worldwide demand for it. And what I saw was more and more corruption of police and government officials, either participating in the drug trade or protecting it. Like, for example, when I was with the Marines, this was in 2012, we learned that people were paying $150,000 a year to buy the position of chief of police in a district out in the middle of absolute nowhere with a mud brick police building. Now, you knew there had to be some profit in there to make this kind of investment worthwhile.
Just to add there, that money would be paid to Karzai, right? And his brother was a...
Well, it got paid up the chain of command within the Ministry of the Interior, went all the way up to Karzai appointees.
Mm-hmm.
And from... You know, my discussions with Afghan friends during all the years I was there, the sort of understanding seemed to be more than a suspicion that the Karzai family controlled the drug trade in the South. His half-brother, Ahmed Walid Karzai, until he was assassinated, was the local kingpin in Kandahar.
So let's try and figure out then what it is about. We can't figure out what makes Jeff Sessions tick and why he's turning back the clock, except there are some winners in reviving the drug law. That is the private prisons. And, well, anybody else? I'm trying to think around who the winners are.
Well, there are, you know, a good rule of thumb anywhere is follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people who benefit from the war on drugs. For example, the DEA. The Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. A lot of people would be out of a job if we said, whoops, we made a mistake making this illegal. Police departments all over the country who are getting federal grant money if they set up narcotics units. There's also something called the 1033 program, by which the Defense Department passes out surplus army equipment to local police forces for the purpose of fighting drugs. And this is everything from automatic weapons to MRAPs, you know, those big mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles that were developed for Iraq. You know, since I think 98, they passed out over $4 billion worth of equipment. So there are a lot of goodies that get passed out during the drug war. And there might be some police departments that would downsize if they weren't spending their time chasing after drug cases.
But the idea that Sessions has this obsession over marijuana, and we have an opioid epidemic in this country, it's manifest. Congress people from both the Democratic and the Republican side have been wringing their hands over this for some time. It's pretty extraordinary to think that you can have a drug manufacturer that manufactures OxyContin putting this stuff on the market unimpeded, and yet here you've got the focus of the new drug warrior, Jeff Sessions, on marijuana when you have a real problem. And whenever they do this, they never look at the reason. The fundamental question is never asked, which is, why do people take drugs? And my sense is that we should be, as a society, we should be looking into why it is that so many people in the heartland of this country feel the need to anesthetize themselves with prescription drugs like OxyContin. And have you ever heard of that question being asked, which is, why do people take drugs in the first place?
Oh, it's something, yeah, a lot of us talk about, but it hasn't thus far been of much interest at the federal level. Maybe it's more fun to prosecute people. Certainly some of the huge problems we're seeing with heroin and meth addiction are places like West Virginia or Eastern Oregon, very economically depressed, few options. Those are the problems, as you point out, that we should be putting our money toward. Instead of spending all the money on police, prosecutors, prisons. No, but when you think about some of the incentives and who's profiting from the status quo, you know, think of all the advertising that's done for pharmaceutical prescriptions. I think we are the only country, other than maybe New Zealand, that allows direct-to-consumer advertising of drugs. So, among other things, we've become a society where people are constantly told, hey, take a pill to solve the problem. You know, don't worry about losing weight or exercising. And the drug companies are making a lot of money out of OxyContin. And perhaps Sessions doesn't want to do anything that would dent their profits. There's also some evidence that the feds keep, you know, poo-pooing, that in states which have legalized marijuana, there are fewer problems with opioid addiction. Because people who actually have a physical pain, if they use medical marijuana, may never need that OxyContin prescription.
Well, now it's insane, though. The insanity has gotten even compounded on television, because now they're advertising drugs for opiate induced constipation. So, in other words,
yes, I saw that one. I love it.
You take the drug because
something is seriously wrong here.
Right, right.
But, you know, we complain about Jeff Sessions, but in a way, you know, it's almost unfair to complain at him, because what he is doing is enforcing the letter of the law that have been passed by Congress and signed over the years by various presidents. And I do fault President Obama for this. Now, he got some credit for being progressive because he wrote a memo back in 2011, I think, directing U.S. attorneys to try not to trigger mandatory minimum sentences, but to be, you know, more reasonable about this. That's the directive that Sessions just overturned. So Obama did not do anything to change the drug laws. He left it all on the books and said, you know, hey, let's just not enforce this all the way. What Sessions is doing is actually more intellectually defensible. It's on the books. Let's enforce it. The answer here is not complaining at Sessions. It's getting Congress to change those laws.
So given I just wanted to just get a sense, though, of what of whether there would be more enlightened. Obviously, as long as Sessions is in there, it's a catastrophe. And as long as the Republicans are in power. But will the Democrats? I mean, it's a very hard thing. I mean, I never understand why they roll over for this accusation. Oh, you want to legalize drugs. Why, you know, semantics are very important. And the political left and the Democrats are not very good at semantics. The Republicans are great at framing things, like, for example, the abortion issue. It's much better to be pro-life than pro-choice. So can they reframe this as saying, as they've tried to do with guns? In other words, they don't talk about gun control anymore. They talk about gun safety, which seems to be a slight improvement. Could you refer to not legalizing drugs, but medicalizing the situation or medicalizing?
Well, I hate to use medicalizing because, you know, lots of people are using pot just because they feel like it instead of having a glass of beer.
Yeah.
So I'd hate to think that, oh, the entire thing is a public health problem. It is in part, but there's also a libertarian argument.
Mm-hmm. Well, how would you best approach this and give it some legal traction and stop this? I mean, it was the people of the United States had had enough of prohibition. They rejoiced when FDR overturned it. So how do we get the people of this country to push the politicians out of the way?
Well, I think that's what's going to happen, because now more than half of the states have legalized marijuana in some form, whether it's just medicinal or also recreational. Though I don't like the term recreational. We need to get away from that. It's simply adult use. I mean, nobody says, let's go out for a recreational beer. Using that term recreational is almost stigmatizing it as, hey, this is something you don't seriously need to be doing. And I think as more and more of the states, and they're all raking in the tax revenue on this, I think we're going to reach a tipping point where there are so many states that have legalized and have a stake in keeping it that way, that is going to give the political cover to the senators and representatives from those states who are finally going to say, okay, we're going to change this.
Well,
so we need to get the states, more and more of them, benefiting.
Well, Inga Franklin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Inga Franklin, who is a former Chicago prosecutor and City of Chicago department head. She spent 5 years in Afghanistan working with local governments and the judiciary and advising the U.S. Army and Marine Corps. At the request of the U.S. Army War College, she wrote Our Disastrous Afghan Drug War and has an article at Vox. I prosecuted drug offenders in the 1980s. It was a disaster. Why is Sessions taking us back? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was